Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 9, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on stealth regulation, agencies circumvention of OIRA, and the APA. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts. The first is Dr. John D. Graham, who is Dean at the Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and the former administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs from 2001 to 2006, also known as OIRA. And our second expert is Professor Todd J. Zwicky, who is the Foundation Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law and Senior Scholar at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. So without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Dr. Graham. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Christian, and good afternoon to everyone. I'm going to lay out a few remarks about the federal regulatory process, and then actually suggest some ways that Congress could take action to improve that process, and in the process give you some case studies of real-world experience in both the Obama administration and the George W. Bush administration. So to set the stage, when a federal agency proposes a significant regulatory action, in theory that action must be reviewed by an office in the White House before it is issued in the Federal Register. This office is, as already mentioned, is OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, and it is an arm of the Office of Management and Budget, which is an arm of the Executive Office of the President. You might ask, with all of these experts and politicians and the regulatory agencies, why in the world do we need to waste the White House time getting involved in all these regulations? Well, it turns out that OMB review of regulations is designed to serve three purposes. One is to ensure that the agencies are acting in ways that are consistent with the president's priorities. And just a reminder that the regulators that are in the cabinet agencies, in theory, in a unified view of the executive branch of the federal government, in theory, the president's supposed to be in charge of the executive branch of the federal government. So having the agencies run off and do things that are inconsistent with what the president wants would not normally be considered a good government process unless it was forced by Congress or some kind of judicial order that forced the president's hand. So the first point is we want to give the White House and the president an opportunity to let their policy preferences play on the regulatory activity. Second thing we want to do with OMB review is to coordinate related actions of different federal agencies. In fact, in some cases, you might have two federal agencies who are issuing regulations that are conflicting with each other. And this doesn't make for good government, and the idea is that OMB can mediate this conflict and try to develop a consistent position of the federal government. This is particularly important when we're dealing with issues that have international ramifications, where we want the federal government to speak with a single voice, or we have businesses or nonprofit organizations that are being regulated, and they need to know which of these two agencies they should adhere to. The third purpose of this OMB review is to assure that there's kind of a reasoned analysis of the benefits and costs of the regulation before it's enacted. You can think of this as kind of a minimal evidence-based requirement that we want to make sure what the agency has in mind has been carefully considered and that all relevant evidence has been considered. So this process of OMB review has been going on now for over 30 years. It was initiated originally under President Reagan in 1981. But what I want to highlight in my remarks today is a variety of ways that this process has been eroded by a variety of regulatory and quasi-regulatory activities that are occurring outside the purview of OMB review and outside the purview of any cost-benefit review from an evidence point of view, from an evidence perspective, excuse me. So some of these activities that I'm referring to are clearly regulatory in the sense that they create binding legal obligations on regulated entities. But other activities I'm going to talk about might be considered quasi-regulatory because they shape the regulatory environment and they impact regulated entities, but they're not necessarily or directly binding in a legal sense. So I'm going to talk about four categories of this quasi-regulatory activity that's occurring outside of OMB review. One is the issuance by agencies of documents such as memoranda, policy statements, and guidance documents. The second is agency approval of state regulatory policies under federal laws that authorize selective waiver of federal preemption of state regulation. Third, I'm going to talk about federal agency issuance of hazard determinations related to technologies, substances, or practices that impact the litigation and regulatory environment for the producers or innovators of these technologies. And finally, I'm going to talk about federal agency litigants who are favoring certain regulatory outcomes and an agency in the litigation process commits itself to a non-discretionary duty to initiate regulation in an area without any OMB review or cost-benefit analysis. So those are the four categories, and let me proceed directly to each of them. The first are these quasi-regulatory documents, policy statements and guidance documents and so forth. A vivid illustration of this occurred early in the Obama administration, and it dealt with the controversial subject of mountaintop mining for coal in Appalachia. It turns out that an increasing fraction of coal is mined in this fashion as surface mining has proved to be more economical and safer for miners than the deep underground mining that most people think of when they think of coal mining in West Virginia. There are, however, a lot of adverse environmental impacts of mountaintop mining, particularly if the reclamation efforts afterwards are not done appropriately. Now, it turns out under the Clean Water Act, the Army Corps of Engineers has the authority to issue 5-year permits for mountaintop mining activities. And they laid this out in what's called Permit 21 in 1982, and they updated this in 2007. So this general permit serves as the basis for a lot of specific activities that are done by the Corps at specific sites where companies are seeking permission to initiate mountaintop mining activities. From 2000 to 2008, there were 511 of these mine reclamation projects approved in West Virginia alone under the procedures in this permit. After President Obama was elected, and within 6 months of his election, the Environmental Protection Agency issued a press release with the title, "Obama Administration Takes Unprecedented Steps to Reduce Environmental Impacts of Mountaintop Coal Mining and Announces Interagency Action Plan to Implement Reforms," unquote. It was this press release was accompanied by a memorandum of understanding signed by EPA, the Army Corps, the Department of Interior, which basically signaled a big shift in regulatory policy toward greater restrictions on mountaintop mining by allowing, in effect, the EPA, in addition to the states, to make project-by-project determinations in addition to the previous activities of the Corps. This led to extensive litigation over many years, and the early rounds of litigation were won by the industry. The more recent rounds of litigation have been won by the EPA. And I don't really know. I'm not a lawyer, as you will soon realize. But I'm not even sure that this is all fully resolved from the litigation point of view. But what I find interesting about this case is the Obama administration was able to shift the whole course of regulatory policy on mountaintop mining without ever issuing a general regulatory change through a normal OMB review process and without actually doing a cost-benefit analysis of mountaintop mining compared to the alternative ways of developing coal or energy resources. So it's an interesting case where, in fact, it all may be lawful in the way the current laws are written, the Clean Water Act and the other related legislation that underpins the Corps' authority. And so my point is that there needs to be some checks put by Congress on this type of activity to make sure that it is done under good government principles. The second example I want to give you is the cases where the federal government has the authority to preempt state and local governments, but chooses not to do so and allows the state governments to regulate. And that type of activity is often not done without any OMB review or cost-benefit review, even though some of those state and local regulations have national economic impacts. Now, certainly under the principle of federalism, there's often a strong case for allowing each state to develop its own public policies. Local conditions in the states will vary, the preferences of their citizens may vary, and state policy can be seen as a source of innovation and learning. So allowing this to occur to a substantial extent has some policy rationale. An exception to this preference for states' rights may occur in settings where regulated businesses produce products in one state but sell them in many other states. And in this context, you can actually have state regulatory activity generating costs for the national economy where it might be more efficient to handle this through a federal regulatory program. A good example of where this issue arises is the state of California has proposed that a certain percentage of cars sold in California should have to have zero emissions. And this regulation called the ZEV program, Zero Emission Vehicle Program, will run up to roughly 15% of new cars by, I think it's 2025. And California was authorized to be able to do this type of regulation under the Clean Air Act, but only if EPA gave them a waiver which allowed them to proceed. And only one state is given this ability to act separately, which is California. The other states either have to sign on to California's program or they have to abide by the U.S. EPA program. To make a long story short, in the Bush administration, this permission was declined on the grounds that it wasn't necessary and that the kinds of greenhouse gases that would be controlled, you couldn't make a significant impact on those through California action alone, and the rule would be significantly costly. The Obama administration reversed this and has allowed state of California to proceed with a ZEV program, which is actually quite expensive, and there's a significant body of literature questioning how much environmental benefit will actually come from this program. Now, this is a case where EPA made the waiver decision allowing California to move forward, but there was never a cost-benefit analysis and never a formal OMB review of this action. So it's a rule with very substantial implications. In fact, there are now a number of states, I think it's 10 of them, including New York, Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts, who have all signed on to this California program. So roughly one in four cars sold in America are going to be subject to this regulation if these current states continue to be a part of the program. The third example I want to give you is the case of hazard determinations with regard to technology. And here the concern is if you declare a technology hazardous, but you don't have a very strong basis for that determination, are there any checks and balances on that determination? And I'm particularly interested in cases where the federal government doesn't move forward and regulate based upon that. It simply floats out the hazard determination and lets the marketplace or state and local regulators proceed. And a good example of that is a recent decision to declare that the chemical formaldehyde causes leukemia. It's been known for many years that formaldehyde causes a rare form of nasal cancer, but the notion that formaldehyde causes leukemia is controversial in the scientific community. There was even a National Academy of Sciences report calling into question the reasoning that the Environmental Protection Agency used for its preliminary determination that formaldehyde causes leukemia. But in the final analysis, the agency has the authority to make these determinations, even though they can have the equivalent regulatory impact of actually a federal regulation. They can have this impact through stimulating tort litigation. They can have this impact by stimulating state and local regulation, or simply by stimulating businesses to say, I don't want any more products that have formaldehyde in them because the federal government has said this is dangerous. So what I'm suggesting is there needs to be some form of either review inside the government or some kind of independent scientific review that has some teeth behind it to make sure that these determinations are done properly. The final example I want to give you is the case where you have pro-regulation interest groups who sue the federal government seeking to get a commitment from the federal government to go forward with a regulation in the future. The idea here is that if they can use the power of the petition to persuade the agency to commit to a rulemaking, then they have some assurances that the agency will move forward, and if they don't, they can go to court and enforce this consent agreement that they reach with the agency. One of the fascinating features of this process is that there's the agency's decision to agree with the litigant and commit to a rulemaking. And typically, this is a non-discretionary commitment that they make in a consent decree. It's not subject to any cost-benefit analysis about whether it would be a good idea to have the regulation, and it's not subject to OMB review. So it should not surprise you that pro-regulation forces inside a regulatory agency may, in a sense, be happy to be sued and be happy to agree in collaboration with the Justice Department to a settlement that forces a rule. A good example that I had in my own experience is I joined the George W. Bush administration in 2001 and soon learned that a $1 billion regulation of mercury coming from coal-fired power plants had been signed in a consent decree process. And it took about 2 years for people to fully explain to me the fact that I didn't really have any choice. We had, as the Bush administration, to move forward with this because a non-discretionary duty had been created. So I hope I've stimulated some of your thinking on your own parts about the way in which the federal government generates regulatory activity without necessarily going through the normal steps of OMB and presidential oversight or without going through the process of cost-benefit review. I'm looking forward to your comments and questions, but at this stage, I think I will pass the baton to my colleague and let him take us into the financial world.
Thanks, John, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I also wanted to mention, for those who are interested in this, the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy published a symposium that has a number of papers with an introduction by John and James Brogel, and that touches on a lot of these issues and gives a lot of these case studies. People want to follow up for more detail. I think it's worth taking a step back in a little broader perspective, and then I'm going to add some financial examples and some examples where this process is really kind of run amok. I think the first thing to keep in mind is why do we have this apparatus? And we've sort of tried the other model. We saw in the New Deal we basically created a bunch of regulatory agencies largely immune from any sort of popular or judicial oversight. Or review by the executive branch, and we saw what that brought us. It basically brought us the 1970s. It brought us a system of unresponsive regulation that basically blanketed the economy with all kinds of regulations, often contrary to one another, inconsistent, and basically brought dynamism in the economy and entrepreneurship to a halt, which is one of the reasons why, as John mentioned, that in the Reagan administration, they decided to try to get their hands around this regulatory behemoth and try to make it more responsive. And I think what we're learning today is we're unfortunately relearning the lessons that we learned in the 70s, which is what happens when you create a regulatory state without any sort of proper checks and balances on it. And we could go further than that, which is that out of that experience in the 1970s, a whole body of scholarship arose, basically people studying the dynamics of regulation. And what we came to learn is that while bureaucracies have certain benefits to them, they are also have certain inherent pathologies associated with them. So that comes about, both the benefits and the costs come about from the same basic force, which is some degree of insulation from political accountability. And so various things we saw, for instance, is that bureaucracies tend to be inherently expansive and have a tunnel vision focus on their particular agenda. And there's a variety of reasons why that may be. But the reality is that if you're at the EPA, you tend to simply weigh the interest of the environment, either by your own inclination, by the incentives of your agency or something else, heavier than you might other things, say national defense, economic growth, or things like that. And so, as John described, the whole purpose of OIRA is to try to knit those things together, to basically deal with the fact that what you have within the executive branch or in the regulatory apparatus itself, and to some extent, is this advocacy process, this adversary process, where different agencies pursuing their own interests tend to overweight their interest relative to the interest of other agencies and in other interests. And so this is why it's so important to have these sorts of things like OIRA and the like. It's also important to have things like active congressional oversight, as John described, which is, it really is a system of checks and balances. And the idea is just as the Constitution itself puts together a president, a Congress, and a judiciary, all with different methods of appointment and election, and believes that the sort of clash among these different things will result in a better outcome in the end, that's basically the same process, obviously, that we have for rulemaking and should be for regulation. So we've kind of come up with this game now where the where certainly this executive branch tries to evade Congress, and Congress, it's kind of a race between Congress and the executive branch rather than a system in which they each bring certain advantages to the table that should be, that should create a better outcome in the end. And unfortunately, what we're doing, as John described, was we're basically acting as if we've forgotten all the lessons of the 70s, everything that happened. So I want to focus for a minute on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, as a brand new agency, sort of is the apotheosis, the role model, the poster child of what this modern regulatory state looks like. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as you may know, gets its budget authorized directly by Congress, which was, but basically directly from the Federal Reserve. They get 12% of the revenues of the Federal Reserve. Last year, that was $600 million, no questions asked. They simply send a one-page letter and says, send us the money. Congress does not have appropriations control. The director is appointed for a five-year term, removable only for cause. And so as a result, he's not accountable to the president. The agency itself has written into the statute mandatory Chevron deference, which is to say that the statute itself says that if the interpretation of the CFPB clashes with any other agency, say the Office of Control of the Currency or something like that, for any statute that is under their jurisdiction, you're required to defer to the CFPB. So what you basically have is insulation from the president, insulation from Congress, insulation from the judiciary, and the like. And what are we seeing at the CFPB? We're basically seeing what happens when you release bureaucrats into the wild without adult supervision, which is exactly these problems we've described, of an agency that is expansionist, that is going beyond its bounds, and in connection with other agencies, we see sort of extraordinary actions being taken. So let me just give two examples and then open the floor to questions. Let's talk about the first one, which isn't directly attributable to the CFPB, but is in the same general space and seems to be largely a function of the DOJ and the FDIC. This is the what you may have read about, which is called Operation Choke Point. And in fact, there's a column today in the Wall Street Journal by an American Indian spokesman talking about Operation Choke Point and the effect that it's having. And if you're not familiar with Operation Choke Point, what it is an initiative that basically seeks to choke off the oxygen, in the terms of the Obama administration, for allowing payments to be made in certain industries, payday lending, home-based charities is an example they give, and the like. And what we are discovering is that companies in industries that are politically disfavored are basically losing their bank accounts, and they're finding out that it's probably because the banks are being strong-armed into not banking them anymore. So, for instance, certain firearms dealers who have lost bank services that they've had for some 20 years. We've seen pornography performers who have lost their services. And we saw today payday lenders or small dollar lenders operating from American Indian reservations are losing their payment services, basically because they are in an industry that that the bank regulators and the DOJ don't like. Now, essentially what we are seeing, as John said, is without any sort of cost-benefit analysis, without any sort of transparency, they are essentially destroying completely legal businesses through the process of simply a wink and a nudge kind of regulation over banks, simply because they have banks under their thumb, and the banks don't have any ability to or necessarily desire to try to thwart their regulators. And so essentially what they're doing is making it more and more difficult for the payday lenders, for instance, to conduct business in these other sorts of industries, all without any sort of serious authorization. And if you read their internal documents, as Congressman Issa has found in his oversight hearings, basically what they say is, it's not our job to take care as to whether or not certain payday lenders are legal or illegal. If they are truly providing a legal service, then the burden should be on them to demonstrate it, is essentially what the position is. And so they're essentially outlawing completely legitimate businesses or raising the cost through a completely non-transparent process. Second example I would give relates to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the regulation of loans by auto dealers. Now, in Dodd-Frank, there is a specific carve-out for auto dealers from the reach of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, and says that the CFPB has no authority to regulate auto dealers, the guys at the car dealership when they make a loan. So what they are doing instead is, even though they can't reach them, they are basically making banks and other companies that provide money to the auto dealers, basically the indirect lenders, they're making them responsible and liable for any disparate impact that occurs with respect to lending by the auto dealers, even though the dealers themselves do not provide any race or other demographic information to the indirect auto lenders when they send out basically the files for bids to make loans. Essentially, what they're doing is deputizing private businesses to regulate auto dealers, which the CFPB specifically has no authority to regulate under Dodd-Frank itself. I think these are good examples that show the point, which is that when you don't have any sort of tools for oversight, when you don't have any sort of active oversight, what you have is sort of the potential for bureaucrats run wild, for them to essentially pursue their own agendas, to kind of get on their own hobby horses, and to act in an expansionist way to pursue their own goals without any sense of what impact it might have on other sorts of policies. And so I think the end result is that we come back and that we're painfully relearning the lessons we learned in the 70s, which is that a responsive, transparent regulatory system that has systems of checks and balances built into it can end up not only improving the outcome of regulations and the impact on the economy, but that whole process can raise the quality of the regulatory process as accountability can basically make the regulatory process more rigorous on the front end so that it's less sloppy and has fewer unintended consequences on the back end. And I'll stop there.
All right. Well, if it's okay with both of our speakers, we can go to questions. Unless Dr. Graham, do you have anything you want to add before we go to questions?
Nothing here.
All right. Great. Well, we'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. All right, well, it looks like we have one question jumping on the line that we'll go right to.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It's worthwhile to examine some of the writings of Cass Sunstein, who has laid out a kind of manifesto of what he calls libertarian paternalism, although most of us don't think that it's very libertarian at all. But in which essentially he tells us what they're doing, which is to engage in actions which, while not directly regulatory, because it would be unconstitutional to regulate in certain ways, nevertheless nudge behavior and expect to drive a kind of emergent behavior. Now, we've seen that in a number of ways in which essentially the government is dividing and conquering the entire economy and the entire society, playing off different elements of it against each other and co-opting them into cooperating in gaining complete control over our lives. An outstanding example that you should examine is the way, for example, that effectively there is now a license to work, because in the name of protecting against the hiring of undocumented workers, which of course there is no constitutional authority to do anyway, every employer feels the need to verify the citizenship of his workers. They're required to fill out I-9 forms, even though they don't necessarily check on their accuracy. Yet they're held accountable for them, even if they couldn't do anything about the accuracy of them. And what that is essentially doing is requiring people to go through the hoops, even if they're natural-born citizens. Even if they've lived here all their lives, you can't get a job now without getting the permit from the government. Similarly, with opening a bank account, the Patriot Act said, well, the banks have to know their customers. And then they came out with a letter that says, well, if you get the Social Security number of the customer, we'll consider that to satisfy this requirement. And now all of a sudden the banks are requiring everyone to submit a Social Security number or they won't open an account. Now, that is just a way of licensing all banking, not just for the banks, but for every individual. And now they're making it more and more difficult for people to conduct cash transactions or perhaps even to hold cash at all. So, what we have is a subversion of the Constitution through this kind of stealth process. And it's not going to be addressed by just nipping at the edges. I mean, we need to decide among ourselves. We need to totally dismantle the administrative state. I mean, we have to do away with everything that it does. We can't pick and choose. We've got to go after it all, no matter how politically difficult that might be.
Do either of you want to comment on that?
I do want to offer comments on parts of it. I don't know the immigration situation well enough to comment on that piece, but I do want to comment on the relationship between this emerging field of behavioral economics and the idea that we should be the government should be actively engaged in nudging people in the direction of what the regulators feel are the more appropriate behaviors and so forth. And I want to illustrate to people how this kind of reasoning is playing out in a regulatory setting that I know of, which is in the setting of the standards for the miles per gallon requirements for cars. Now, normally when people think about nudges, they're thinking about, well, you would frame information to people in a way, or choices to people in a way, where they would still be able to choose one way or the other, but you would sort of nudge them in one direction or the other, either with the information or the framing of the choice. And we've done that to a certain extent in the design of the label on new cars. When you go to buy a new car, it has a miles per gallon rating, and then it has some new information on it, which is designed to tell you how much money you'll save if you buy this car compared to the average car that's out there, and so forth. But one thing I want to alert people to that is going on is this same kind of behavioral economics argument that people aren't really able to, you know, judge how much they want a more fuel-efficient vehicle. It's also being used to argue for a legal compulsion that automakers have to sell a certain number of vehicles, or they have to meet a fleet-wide average of, say, 50 miles per gallon by 2025. I mean, it's one thing to say that you're just going to offer people more information or to give them more choices, and it's another thing to compel them under an argument of nudge.
Yeah, I would just elaborate on that point. John, thanks for your thanks for your comments. Another example that relates to what John was just saying is there's a working paper that Mercatus has done with respect to basically the use of behavioral economics with respect to environmental regulations and that sort of thing, and the way in which they are using those sorts of techniques in the cost-benefit process to basically talk about the benefit, the private benefits of certain regulations, and basically weighing that in the balance, so that basically if I would save a certain number of dollars by buying an energy efficient refrigerator, they want to count that in the cost benefit analysis and then basically compel me to buy that refrigerator or take less efficient refrigerators off the market. One other example I would have with respect to behavioral economics that is unfolding, it relates to bank overdraft protection that shows some of the problems that we have, which is you may be familiar that a few years ago the Federal Reserve amended Regulation E, and what they did as part of that was required consumers to opt in to bank overdraft protection as it relates to to point-of-sale and ATM transactions. And basically what they discovered afterwards was that people who used bank overdraft protection the most were the ones who were most likely to opt in to using it, and so basically continued to use it. To which adherence to behavioral economics said, well, the problem with this is it just shows that the nudge wasn't strong enough. Here we were trying to save these people from themselves, and they still went ahead and kept using bank overdraft protection. When, of course, the reality, as I've shown in some of my research, is the reason why people use bank overdraft protection primarily is because people who use it have limited credit options, and basically they're choosing between overdraft protection and payday lending. And given that, people use it pretty rational given that particular choice. And so the reason they opted in was because if they didn't, they'd basically be using payday lending and the like. But it does show what happens if you start getting away from both those examples, from getting away from rigorous cost-benefit analysis. And John, I just invite you, if you are inclined, to one criticism I often hear from people is that the cost-benefit analysis is too slippery to be effective. That it's so easily circumvented that it doesn't really provide much of a breaker in the regulatory process. And I'd just be interested in your thoughts on that, John, if I could ask a question to the speaker, Chris.
Absolutely.
Sure, and I'm happy to respond to that. I think one thing that we would all like to find in the solution to these regulatory excess issues is the one kind of piece of therapy that by itself is going to, you know, make a dramatic difference in the result. And my experience from working in this field for 30 years is that none of the key checks and balances by itself is highly potent. Judicial review by itself is not highly potent. Congressional oversight is not highly potent. Cost-benefit analysis requirements are not highly potent. And I don't share the view of our first caller that we have to sort of like take down the whole administrative state. That's the only way to solve this problem, because I think there are enough constructive uses of federal regulation that we're going to need to have federal regulation in a variety of these areas. So my view is that you have to think about this as finding a variety of different mechanisms together whose cumulative impact is to cause a more deliberative and democracy-respecting regulatory state. Part of the problem is the state needs to be sensitive to evidence, even if it's unpopular for the regulatory state to do so. And then in other cases, it's responding to what people want in terms of their well-considered preferences. And these are not easy to distinguish. But having multiple mechanisms of checks and balances, I think, is important. And cost-benefit analysis is a modest check. It's not going to dramatically change the flavor of the regulatory state. But I think on balance, it's caused agencies to be more sensitive to issues of the rationale. Why are we doing this? And how much is this going to cost? And so forth. And forcing an agency to ask those questions, I think, is constructive.
All right. Well, this is Christian. Our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Again, our lines are open, so you can press star and then the pound key. Well, while we're waiting for more callers to get on the line, I do have a couple of questions prepared. Some might argue that imposing specific economic analysis requirements on regulatory agencies could be unnecessarily burdensome. Could you talk a little bit more about what factors might distinguish a burdensome analysis requirement from a useful one? And then secondly, what would have to happen to get agencies to do economic analysis for stealth regulation activities versus avoiding it as they do now?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is what some of the scales of numbers are that we're talking about here. The cost to the federal government at a particular agency of doing a cost-benefit analysis or the entire regulatory analysis package, which might include, engineering documents or financial documents, it would typically, be in the range of, say, $100,000 to like upwards of maybe, you might be able to get to $5 or $7.5 million for a gigantic rule, $5 to $7.5 million. But these packages are only being required on rules that cost the economy $100 million or more. And in many cases, these rules cost over $1 billion. It doesn't require one to believe that these analyses are going to make a very large change, an improvement in a regulation, in order to justify the analysis requirement itself on a cost-benefit test. So I think it's appropriate for people who are skeptical of analytical requirements to ask questions about whether they're overly burdensome and so forth and so on. We have to keep in mind the relatively small number of regulations that are currently being required to have this type of analysis and how much burden and how large and expensive they are. So that would be my overall reaction to that concern.
John, about how many regulations a year did you guys have to review that reached that threshold?
Yeah, we could get the actual numbers through Richard Williams at the Regulatory Study Center at George Mason at the Mercatus Center, or through the OMB website. My recollection is that while there are on the order of thousands of regulatory notices issued every year, the number that actually have an in-depth analysis of the form we're talking about here is on the order of the hundreds, so not thousands. The other thing people should keep in mind is the review staff at OMB in the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. I think I had roughly 50 analysts at the time when I was at OMB, and that number has declined steadily since 2000. I think it's now under 40. They're not in a position, quite frankly, to do serious analytic work on more than these couple hundred regulations a year. So unless we're going to make a significant investment in the expansion of the staffing at an agency like OIRA, I think we have to face the reality that there's only going to be a modest amount of this activity done. And what that suggests, I think, is that we also need to be thinking about how to build in independent peer review and analytic checks on agencies at the agency itself, and not simply rely at OMB at the end of the pipe to try to fix a lot of these issues.
John, if I could just ask you another question. One idea that's been proposed is to put independent agencies, FTC, SEC, the like, under OIRA. Do you have any thoughts on that? What impact that would have on the size of the job that OIRA would have anything like that? Recognizing that that's a politically perilous question, potentially. I'll let you answer it any way that you like.
Yes. Well, I think in principle, I think it's a sound idea. One way to think about this is that one of the principal rationales for OMB review is that the president, as our leading elected official, bears political accountability for the actions of the federal government. And I think that since these independent agencies are having a substantial impact on the economy, and since the president's going to be accountable for how the economy is going, I think it makes more sense to give the president some ability to oversee those operations like they do at agencies, you know, cabinet agencies in the executive branch. And if you actually try to do an analysis and try to determine why are the agencies that are independent and outside of the White House oversight, what is it about them that are different than the ones that are inside the cabinet agencies and within the purview of presidential oversight? I've never been able to determine a rational, logical pattern for that separation. So I guess what I would say from a logical point of view, it seems to me they should all be either under the president's supervision or they should all be outside the president's supervision. You can make them all arms of the Congress, and then you build in some type of OMB-type operation within the Congress to help address these issues. But the makeup we have now, I don't think it has anything other than history to actually justify it.
Well, it looks like we had one question jump on the line during that exchange. So we actually have two questions now. So we'll two questions on the line, and then our lines will be open. So we'll go to the first question now.
Hi, this is Chris Green at the University of Mississippi. I'm curious to what extent the OIRA itself is kind of not wanting to be in the process. Is that a problem? Do we need you know, a change to the executive order, the 12866, and the later ones, or to what extent do we need statutory funding for more people, or to what extent is the problem, you know, at the White House?
Well, I think one thing to remember is these various checks and balances we're talking about. So we have OMB is one, judicial review is another, congressional oversight is another. OMB review works well when the president and the president's closest advisors are committed to OMB review. Then they will both provide not only the resources to hire good people in the office, but they'll back up the analysts who are in OIRA who are seeking to accomplish improvements or in some cases simply denying permission for new regulatory activities. I think what you'll find is that in all presidential administrations since the Reagan administration when OMB was created, the White House has an appetite to support OMB in some kinds of regulations. And in other cases, they simply don't back them up. So, for example, when I was at OMB, after 9/11, there was a kind of a sea change. And all of a sudden, we thought we were a group of, you know, conservatives who were trying to limit the size of regulatory activity as much as possible. And all of a sudden, we had proposals coming out all over across the White House about new regulations that we're going to adopt to prevent the next terrorist. And the emotions were running so high at the time, it was very hard to ask critical questions about these ideas and to raise concerns about whether is it really a good idea to ban all foreign students coming to the United States, so forth and so on. So here I found myself, you know, with a whole bunch of my colleagues who were political conservatives. They wanted to regulate like mad. And you'll see that in other administrations as well. And I think in Democratic administrations, in areas like labor and environmental, you're going to find presidents and the White House staff, they're not as inclined to want to back up OMB and really, you know, force these agencies to do cost-benefit analysis. So OMB alone will not solve the problem, because the White House will only back them up in certain cases and on certain issues. So you need to have a portfolio of checks and balances on the regulators that goes beyond simply OMB review.
Thanks.
All right. Looks like we still have one more question on the line and about 10 minutes to go. So if you would like to ask a question in the last few minutes, jump on the line now, press star, and then the pound key.
Yeah, this is Kyle McCollum. I'm a student at Southern Illinois University, and I know there's been some different legislative proposals sent out there. I guess I'm speaking particularly on the sue and settle issue, but I know one of them is to have consent decrees actually published in the Federal Register. I wasn't sure if that would be, you know, sort of one of the silver bullets that we would be looking for to end these types of practices.
John Graham here. I think that if what this questioner has in mind is published in the Federal Register and open for public comment before the agency closes on the settlement, I think something like that would be constructive. And I'm not a lawyer by background. You'd have to work on the practicalities of this as it relates to the litigation process itself. But I just think something like that would be constructive.
Yeah,
also, by
here.
The way, would have the advantages it creates a transaction where the agency has to draft that public comment notice, and they've got to get OMB review on that notice before they put it out. And that immediately creates for OMB an ability to know that this is going on. Because in a lot of cases, OMB has no idea that these litigants are out there signing these agreements and committing themselves to new rulemakings.
Yeah, that's a good point. I tend to agree with John. It strikes me as a good idea, whether it's a silver bullet. A lot of these things, I also agree with John, that a lot of them are not going to be silver bullets. And, of course, one of the issues with this is that John said maybe this is a way in which OMB could be involved to provide oversight. But otherwise, the question is, well, who's going to comment on it, and what is the basis for which they're going to comment on it? Who is going to be a party who in some sense takes an interest, except for perhaps some third party, a nonprofit group or something like that, how will that process play out? One could imagine that how you might build out a process like that, but in and of itself, simply requiring it to be published and open to comment doesn't seem to inherently check the practice, unless you have somebody somewhere who has an incentive to basically weigh in and explain why it shouldn't happen. When basically what you have are, you know, consenting parties otherwise at the table.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got one more question on the line, and we'll go right to that. Are you with us?
I'm sorry, I had my mute on. This is Doug Anderson, Chicago. I think the call has been an excellent one. The issues that have been raised highlight some pretty difficult problems in how you address what to do with regulations going forward. And I guess I would say that of the examples that have been cited of the way that the process has gone astray, I think there are probably many, many more in a lot of industries that are as bad or worse than the ones that you guys have talked about, which is one of the really disheartening things about this. But I would ask this question, which is, if you could make one change in either, be it judicial doctrine or some other doctrine with respect to review of regulations that you would think might make a significant difference, what would that be?
Well, I get John Graham speaking. I guess I would, if I could have one and only one, I would have Congress, you know, pass a one or two sentence amendment to the Administrative Procedure Act, which basically incorporates a cost benefit requirement on all federal regulatory activity, both at independent agencies and at cabinet agencies, that's judicially reviewable under standard, you know, arbitrary and capricious tests and so forth.
Hey, Doug, good to hear from you. That strikes me as plausible. It's a question I haven't given that much thought to, but that strikes me as basically the best approach. What I would imagine is something that requires, you know, greater collaboration, greater opportunities for Congress to provide oversight in a more aggressive sort of way, and so maybe cost benefit analysis is the single best thing that could be done, but perhaps another alternative might be something like has been proposed, which would basically be to not only have cost benefit analysis, but basically allow Congress or require Congress or give Congress an opportunity to essentially veto regulations that have certain costs or some sort of trigger like that, which would essentially both require Congress to have greater accountability and give Congress the opportunity to provide greater accountability. That I haven't frankly thought about the question before, so there may be downsides to that particular proposal that I haven't thought through, but that would be another line, would be to think about how to empower Congress in this process.
Just so John Graham here, just so people are aware, there already is a Congressional Review Act provision that allows a vote on a specific rule to overturn. And I don't even think it's susceptible to filibuster and so forth. So I think there already is an ability to do that in the Congress. The real problem you've got to think about, if you primarily want to address this through congressional activity, is the nature of elected officials, their attention span, the time frame on issues they worry about, and the fact that the congressional branch of government is a much more emotion-laden branch than the executive branch, which tends to be more evidence-based, though there are certainly many counterexamples to that. And of course, the judicial branch of government has its own temperament and orientation. My feeling about these issues is we tend to get more progress on dealing with regulatory reform in a constructive way by strengthening the hand of the judicial branch and the executive branch. I really think unless you've got a way to really change the nature of how elected officials think and what their incentives are, they're typically not a good solution to these problems. I hate to be so pessimistic.
All right. Well, we have a couple minutes left. Before we end, I want to switch gears just very quickly. Thinking about, since a lot of the people on the call are attorneys, do you have any advice for thinking about or recommendations on how to think about OIRA and economic analysis as part of legal strategies for clients, maybe incorporate that into a practice?
Well, one point out, John Graham here, one point I would make is that there are a lot of litigation cases, some of them that were launched against rulemakings by the Bush administration that I was involved in and others during the Obama administration. And what litigants are able to do is they're able to go into the regulatory analysis documents and the technical documents that support the regulatory analysis and expose issues that are in those documents and use those to undermine the case for the regulation as being offered by the agency. And you might ask, well, wait a minute, why in the world does this happen? Well, one of the reasons is that agencies, when they're developing these documents, are often developing them early in the process, often with contractors, and they'll be producing a variety of evidence and arguments before the political leadership of the agency or the White House has decided what they want to do with the regulation. And oftentimes, in very awkward ways, at the end of the rulemaking process, the politicians basically decide we want to move the regulation in a certain direction. And they'll force all the write-up of the rulemaking itself to be done that way. But the underlying analytic documents are a different train, and they're going in a different direction. So, for example, there's a famous case called State Farm, and the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that the Reagan administration was arbitrary and capricious in eliminating the requirement to put airbags in all new cars. And the problem there was is the administration made a decision, you know, sort of in the end game, we're not going to do this, but all the cost-benefit analysis said airbags were a great idea. Supreme Court sort of looked at this and looked at all this data and said, well, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. So I think there is a substantial value in looking carefully at the technical documents that underpin these rules and then comparing those to what the actual rule itself is. And oftentimes they don't hold up, they don't hold together.
I'll just add one thought, which isn't directly apropos to OIRA, but based on my experience working at the FTC, and based on some conversations I've had with some people at other agencies, one thing that an economist was telling me recently, a senior economist at one of the agencies, is that when, say, industry files or firm files comments on a proposed regulation and talks about the costs, basically what he said is be specific. Everybody knows the regulations are going to have costs. To just say this is going to be a costly regulation doesn't solve the problem. What he was saying is basically tell us precisely why it's costly. Is it because the computer system doesn't work that way, for instance? And how might it operate in order to be less costly for industry and that sort of thing? Now, that's obviously a marginal sort of thing. But it's something that might at least reduce the overall cost of the regulation and raise some different directions, some different issues that they might not have thought about, in which case then the regulation could be modified or written in some way that reduces the cost that's imposed on industry.
Excellent. Well, it looks like we've exhausted our time and then some. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Professor Zwicky and Dr. Graham for joining us today. Thank you to our audience. As always, we welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And please continue to join us for our telephone conference calls scheduled this week. And a reminder that you can always catch this podcast as well as all of our others posted on our website at fedsoc.org. So until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.